The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Hi. How y'all doing? You good? All right, we are going to go ahead and get started. Tonight should have a slightly different feel to it than last night. Essentially tonight, I want to kind of summarize a couple of ideas from Lewis' life, ideas that I just want to, we're going to be coming back to kind of throughout the evening as we walk through a couple of his books, and then we're going to basically after that transition and just talk through a series of his books. I prepped notes and thoughts and quotes from Abolition of Man, which is really, really important. Nobody's favorite, but it's arguably one of his most important books, so we're going to start there. We'll go from there to the Space Trilogy. Just because it's fun, and I want to get all of you to read it. And then after that, we'll go to Till We Have Faces, and then kind of from there, I am open to suggestions. In fact, I'm open to suggestions all night, but that's kind of my roadmap for where we'll go tonight. Tonight, hopefully, we'll be more interactive, so if you are loud and talkative, that's great. If you have questions, I'll try to stop periodically throughout and ask you if you've got questions or something you want to bring up or some favorite quote or passage that you would like to reference. I saw a couple people with copies of Till We Have Faces out there, which got me very happy. We can reference those as well. So last night probably felt a lot like a lecture. Tonight will feel a little bit of lecture and hopefully more kind of just interaction back and forth. So that's the plan for tonight. I feel better, which is good. My throat... is all right. Last thing before we get going, if you weren't here last night and you would like a handout from last night, please hold your hand up. If you were here last night and you lost your handout and you would like a handout tonight, hold your hand up. And Jeff will run around frantically and try to deliver all of them to you. Is that good? Frantic, more franticness. Okay. Actually, before I pray, I want to mention a couple of books to you guys about Lewis, not by Lewis. That would be great places if you want more. A couple people asked me about biographies last night. I think The Narnian by Alan Jacobs is the best biography out there about him. I would commend it to you, hands down. If you want one biography to pick up, this is the one to read. It's not only very accurate, very good, it's also very entertaining to read. So Alan Jacobs was a professor at Wheaton while I was there. He's great. Now he's at Baylor. Anyway, you can. This book is a fantastic book. The other biography I'd recommend is by Alistair McGrath. It's newer. McGrath is more thorough, which means more boring. But it's also very, very good. So there's a lot of insights gained here, particularly background to some of Lewis's particular thoughts, the battles that are actually going on academically around some of his writings is included more in McGrath's work. It's a fantastic book. I would recommend it as well. But start with Jacobs. This is more of like, hey, you can go read this anywhere. This is more like, okay, I want to get really serious. And you can read that. Last two books I'll mention to you. One, this well, this is for nerds. And so I love this book. It references all of his writings, what happened, how it was reviewed in the papers, personal letters that he wrote referencing why he said certain things in certain books. Everything you'd ever want to know about C.S. Lewis's writings are in here. And so this is called C.S. Lewis, A Complete Guide to His Life and Works by Walter Hooper. It is a nerd's encyclopedia of C.S. Lewis. So if you just want to have something that kind of tells you about everything, this is a great book as well. And then the last one I'll recommend, and this one's kind of hard to find. So it's kind of a nerd's book, but it's actually really helpful. It's called The Christian World of C.S. Lewis, where Clyde Kilby, he was also a professor at Wheaton. Wheaton has kind of a hidden obsession with C.S. Lewis. Kilby takes different Christian themes, different aspects of theology, and attempts to take pieces of Lewis's writings, focusing on his fiction, but he'll get into other things as well, and kind of drawing those into different themes within Christian theology. So that is the fourth book I'll recommend, the final book I'll recommend, about C.S. Lewis and not by C.S. Lewis. But before all of these, read C.S. Lewis and get his books, read them. They will never let you down. They're phenomenal books, and so we'll go from there. Great? Okay, let's begin. So, Father, we come back one more time to consider the writings of this man. God, I pray that you would help us tonight to be helped, that your Spirit would come and take up the thoughts of this man, the work of this man, the vision of this man, and help us in light of that vision, in light of that work, to see and to delight in Jesus more. God, and to treasure your word more, to orient our lives to pursuing you and obeying you more. God, to lay down our lives to the good of our neighbors and our friends more. So God, I pray that you would take Brother Lewis and you would wield him in our midst for your glory and for our good and for our joy. In your name we pray. Amen. I want to begin by mentioning and just kind of getting this in front of you. We talked a little bit about last night, but you need to understand the day and age in which C.S. Lewis was writing, in which he was working, in which he was doing his thing that we talked about last night. You need to know that he was working in one of the most respected academic institutions of any day, Oxford, in the 1920s. He was working in a particular specialty of that school, in literature, English literature in particular, and he was writing kind of at the beginnings of the modern and into postmodern turn, if you will. So the philosophical ideas that are beginning to float around, the movement that is happening within culture, within philosophy, within all kinds of different circles in Lewis' day, shape and define a lot of what Lewis set out to do. And so you have to keep in mind, he's not just writing kind of into the dark. He's not just writing out kind of blank ideas. He's fighting battles on the ground day in and day out. Battles that eventually led to him not being able to get a full professorship at Oxford. An interesting thing about him, he was at Oxford for 30 years, had never been given a full professorship. And then finally Cambridge came and the rival school and offered him one. He accepted it, and the next day Oxford said, okay, we actually want to offer you one and you can stay. And Lewis said, no thanks, and took off. Actually ended his career at Cambridge rather than Oxford, where he'd spent most of his career. And the reason why he wasn't brought on at Oxford is essentially they said, we've got too many of these Christian, old-fashioned people. So Tolkien's there. You've got this growing body of Christians at Oxford, and Oxford looks at it and says, we don't want any more Christians here. And we don't want anyone who's taking the particular point of view, the worldview that Lewis is taking. We don't want to give that any more prestige at the school. And Cambridge was quite willing to take Lewis and his Christianity. And so I just think it's very, very important that we understand that the things that Lewis is addressing are things that he's arguing about day in and day out in his hallways. They're things that he's fighting over all over Oxford. He's not just a public figure who's a Christian who's addressing particular topics that he finds interesting. He sees them as the we're going to see with the abolition of man. He actually sees all of humanity at stake, the survival of humanity, the survival of culture at stake in the battles that he's fighting. And he's at the place where those ideas are being thought through, argued about, and ultimately are going to work their way into the broader and more popular culture. So it's important to see Lewis not just as kind of this cold-headed kind of academic writing interesting stories, writing children's books. I mean, he's actually at war. That's why last night I think I talked about it in terms of him being at war. He very much was. And so with that in mind, I want to bring to the forefront two ideas, one which we talked about all night last night, the other which I don't think I even touched on it last night, but it's really, really important if you're going to understand Lewis. So the first one is joy and its object, right? We talked about that a lot last night. That the pursuit of joy, that theme defined his life, it defined the very course of his life, and he wanted to be where all the beauty comes from. To quote, "Till We Have Faces." And that was his longing, that was his desire. It defined the whole course of his life, and it was ultimately the path that God used to bring him to Christ, was this desire for joy, this desire for to be where all the beauty is ultimately coming from. And over the course of that discovery, and through that kind of philosophical move to see the distinction between contemplating and enjoying, that kind of led him to understand that joy has an object. That in the end, he's not seeking desire itself, he's seeking desire's object. It seems like the most obvious thing in the world to us, but it rails against everything in our age, right? Everything in our age says, look for satisfaction, look for meaning, look for identity from within. So everything in our culture has bought into what Lewis saw incipiently in his own day. And that move to recognize that joy and desire has an object was massive for him. And I want it to be massive for us tonight. And we're going to play this through everything he wrote because it's in everything he wrote. We live in a day and age in which everything about yourself you are told is to be defined from within. What you're to discover about yourself is what you decide. You look within to find that which is true about sexuality, about gender, about any of it. Now play that out over the entirety of our culture, and that's the world we live in. What works for you? What do you want? Where do you find happiness? Where do you find fulfillment? For Lewis and in Lewis's day, those were new ideas being promulgated. This shift in understanding where fulfillment, where identity, where any of those things come from, they'd always just been assumed. Those are things you inherit from the world and the way that the world is. And Lewis is seeing this shift taking place within culture to no longer is truth outside of you, no longer is identity something that you receive from outside of yourself, and now truth is something you look in within to find. Beauty is frankly irrelevant in a lot of the circles in that day, but beauty is primarily in terms of taste. Goodness is what you like, what you prefer. And oh, how much further we've gone down that railroad track since Lewis's own day. Man, for Lewis, this is everything. The fact that truth is objective, it stands outside of us. One way, and we'll look at it later tonight, is that sanity and joy. And then I talked about it last night in terms of growing in humanness or growing as a disciple of Jesus or growing in Christian maturity. And I think all of those are essentially the same thing. It is learning to align your life with the way that the world is. In other words, the way that the world was made by God. The way that it's learning to know that this is good and to do that which is good because God has ordained this is what is good. It is learning to delight in beauty as God determines beauty. It's learning to trust what is true as God determines what is true. That is, and we can call it sanity and we can call it salvation. And that's the whole course of what humanity is to be about. It is learning to conform your life to those things. Insanity and hell are turning constantly away from reality, away from God's word, away from God's being, to find those things in yourself, to find the meaning of truth here, to find what goodness is and morality is here, to try to discern for yourself what beauty is here. And as you look at particularly the book, The Great Divorce, and if you've never read The Great Divorce, I would highly commend The Great Divorce to you. It's a relatively short read. It's entertaining mostly. And at some moment, though, as you read The Great Divorce, you should lift your head, probably multiple times, but you should lift your head while you read it and be horrified at what sin does. I've never seen a clearer picture practically played out of Romans 1, 18 to the end of chapter 1 in my life. As he describes what sin actually is, it's these men and women in endless accounts are so bent in on themselves, so utterly bent by defining what is true, what is beautiful, and what is good on their own terms, that they're literally insane in these conversations. And it drives them ultimately away from other people. It drives them away from God. It drives them away from reality itself. So that the cumulative effects of their sin, the reality of hell, is simply that turn in on the self, unmitigated by grace. Untethered to a gracious God, constantly calling all of humanity outside of itself to see and to behold the grandeur and the beauty and the goodness and the trustworthiness of God. And hell, as it plays out in that book, is simply us being utterly blinded to that and being released to say, you want to chase after your own world, chase after it forever. And the result is pretty mind-blowing in terms of its creativity and its ability to describe the effects of sin on the human person and on the soul. And he describes it in these terms: a refusal to seek our joy in conformity to, in discovery of, ultimately God himself, and then conformity to how God has ordered the world as he's revealed in his word and his law. So that's the first piece that I want to remind you of from last night. We're going to come back to that every single book that we work through. The second thing, and it fits with it, and it has been a point of kind of a lot of humorous reflection on Lewis's life. The man never read a newspaper. He never learned to drive. He never owned a wristwatch. He hated things that were new. In fact, he never learned to type. His brother Warney would type for him. It was a matter of conscience. Lewis just simply didn't want to deal with anything new. He didn't like new things. He liked old clothes. He liked old styles. He liked old things best. And he was suspicious of anything, whether it's technology or books or ideas or any of it. He was naturally suspicious of all of it. One of the things that Lewis should teach us is to avoid the great sin of chronological snobbery. Chronological snobbery is the belief that anything new is enticing, exciting, desirable, somehow inherently better than something that is old. This is largely bought into in our culture on a broad scale through the myth of progress. It's the idea that somehow we've arrived at a level of wisdom or attained a level of wisdom or insight into the world that our forefathers would have never imagined. That we're because of where we are on a timeline, we're wiser, smarter, have greater insight into truth, greater insight into the universe than our ancestors did. Lewis rejected that just sheer out of hat. Just completely. Had no use for it at all. And this is, I think, one of the most liberating aspects of Lewis's work that we can consider. In fact, one of the things that I'm going to go ahead and get into some of the books. One of the things that, in reflecting on the worldview that's inherent in the Space Trilogy, the interesting about the Space Trilogy is it's not science fiction. It's actually, I don't know of any other piece of literature like it. He's taking an ancient medieval cosmology. So he was a medieval literature guy. He was immersed in how people in the 16th century, 17th century thought about everything. So he lived there, breathed that, thought that. He takes that cosmology, that worldview, he takes it, plants it in the 20th century, then puts spaceships in it and lets people travel to discover that the world is not as they seemed, as not as they assumed it was. In fact, the main way he talks about his goal is, if I can get just a small percentage of people who read these books to, instead of using the term space to describe what's out there, to start using the phrase the heavens to describe what's out there, he will have achieved his entire goal in writing the books. The idea there is he says in kind of recounting this move of taking, essentially he's trying to present that worldview in a way that would somehow make sense to us, that cosmology in some sort of way that would make sense to us. He says, now, of course, the medieval worldview isn't true, but even in the way he says it isn't true, Alan Jacobs makes this point. He says it in such a way that you think, yeah, but he kind of thinks it is true. Like he kind of thinks they had it right and we've got it wrong. In other words, that with all of our scientific advances, all of our understanding of physics and those kinds of things, he actually thinks that we've lost something that they had that gave them a more accurate understanding of how the universe actually worked than we do. And we'll get into some of that later. But the whole idea behind chronological snobbery is that we assume that things are better now. We assume that our way of thinking is wiser now. We assume that our way of thinking about gender, about sex, about marriage, about all kinds of things is somehow wiser, more just, better. And yet we have no grounds to think that, other than it's more attuned to our age rather than somebody else's. One of the things that Lewis would suggest to people, he commands us kind of point blank. He says you should read at least 2 old books for every new one. And you should probably largely avoid reading new books. Just read old books over and over and over again. If you think about it, this is incredibly liberating. Because you're not beholden to the latest ideas. You don't have to be beholden to the rush of ways of thinking, ways of dressing, philosophies of living that are just rushing at us and are changing over and over and over and over and over again. But one of the beauties of what Lewis discovered is that you can actually allow time and the ages to begin to sift through all of that mess and begin to actually take in what over the course of time now you can look back and say, hey, that was important. It mattered. It's still around. There were a lot of books written around the time that Calvin's Institutes were written. There's hardly any of them still being published today. Why is Calvin's Institutes still being published? You can disagree with them all you want, but what you have to say is they're important. They matter, right? This is what Lewis liberates you to do. To suddenly discover that just because an idea is new does not make it true or good or beautiful or even important. It may be a complete blip on the screen that disappears in a couple of years. I was talking to a pastor in town a few years ago. We moved here. And one of the things that he was a part of a movement of churches this had kind of gotten hardwired into them. And I was asking him, just, hey, what are the things that you've really appreciated about this movement of churches? And he said is that some of the leaders, they don't give any notice to new movements, new ideas, new writings, new things. In fact, one of the recurring jokes is like, hey, we'll talk about that in 5 years. And this was actually around the time that Love Wins came out. And I said, so what are you guys doing with Love Wins? And he said, well, we brought it up. And the pastor said, well, man, if people are still talking about it in 5 years, we'll deal with it. But it's probably going to be forgotten before that. So why would we take a ton of time and a ton of energy and to think through this when nobody's going to be thinking about it 6 months from now? Lewis liberates us to live that way, to think that way. To learn from the history of the ages, not assuming that they're somehow dumber than us. And so I wanted to hold those two ideas up to you, chronological snobbery, and then kind of immerse you back in this vision of truth as something that stands outside of us, as objective and real and personal, first existing in the person of God. And then learning then to conform to that is what maturity is what salvation is. If I can tell one more story to make it a little more tangible, maybe. I've got an email from old friends of ours, and they'd sent an email. And the question was simply this: how do you discover Jesus in the Bible? They're a Christian family, and they wanted to know, hey, how, when I'm reading the Bible, do I know, is this of Jesus or is this not of Jesus? There's popular teachings in our day where it's this idea that we know who Jesus is. Jesus is really nice and kind and gentle, and he wears generally a white robe with a blue sash, and he smiles a lot and has long hair, and he's gentle and kind and nice, and he would never say something harsh or mean, which is laughable if you read the Gospel of John. But if you don't read the Gospel of John and you take a certain angle on things and you assume everything that our culture has assumed about Jesus for a long time, you can somehow get there. So Jesus is like this. So when we go to parts of Scripture that don't make sense to us, now I'll translate that, parts of Scripture that we don't like, parts of Scripture that seem harsh, parts of Scripture that don't seem to square with the vision of Jesus that we really like, then we can say, well, maybe that's an older, confusing version of who God is, older, confusing vision of what God would ordain for his people. So we're talking about the genocide of the Canaanites. We're talking about even the whole doctrine of election or predestination. We're talking about the whole doctrine of hell, any of those sorts of things. We can kind of cut those out because what we really want is this kernel, this picture of Jesus as a nice white, he's usually white in the paintings, but white-robed, blue-sashed, a man who's gentle and nice and just goes around gushing over people everywhere. And that's kind of this vision of Jesus that we want. And we, in our interactions back and forth, first kind of tackled that and kind of realized like, hey, this is really at the heart of some of these questions. Is they're looking at these hard parts of Scripture and they're walking away confused, frustrated, wanting to find a way to say, well, that's not really what God's like. And here's where this comes to bear. Christian maturity is not going to hard parts of Scripture or going to hard issues within Christian theology, looking at it and saying, I don't really like that. I need to find a way around it. It's like we said last night, it's learning to like broccoli. It's learning how to eat it. It's learning to trust that God has ordained that would nourish us, that it fills out our understanding of the world and who he is. And so I want us to be about that project. If the Bible is true, if God really is God, if sin really has infected us in all the ways the Bible seems to say that it has infected us, then we should expect to find aspects of God's character. We should expect to find aspects of God's nature offensive to us. We should. If our mind has not yet been conformed to the image of God, in other words, if we've not yet been made perfect and holy and righteous, then we should expect to discover things in the Bible that tick us off, that leave us scratching our head and going, I don't know what to do with this. Because God isn't like us, right? So when we meet him, and particularly when we meet him in places where those things come to bear, that we should, if everything about God just kind of conformed what we want to be true, if he was always acting the way we wanted him to act, we would be fearful, we should be fearful that we weren't actually discovering God himself, we were actually making God to be who we wanted him to be. So with those kind of our two starting points, I want to jump into the books now. Before we get into the books, are any questions from stuff we talked about last night? Or anything we've said so far tonight. Try to open it up. None. Oh, nailed it last night. All right. Abolition of Man. Abolition of Man was actually a series of lectures that C.S. Lewis delivered on education to an educational society in England. It is 3 chapters long. It is short. And it is angry. Okay. Lewis begins here. I'm going to read a section of it to you. We're going to do a lot of reading tonight. Is that all right? Okay. I doubt whether we are sufficiently attentive to the importance of elementary textbooks. That is why I've chosen as a starting point for these lectures a little book on English intended for boys and girls in the upper forms of school. I do not think the authors of this book, there were 2 of them, intended any harm, and I owe them, or their publisher, good language for sending me a complimentary copy. At the same time, I shall have nothing good to say of them. Here is a pretty predicament. I do not want to pillory 2 modest practicing schoolmasters who are doing the best they knew, but I cannot be silent about what I think the actual tendency of their work. I therefore propose to conceal their names. I shall refer to these gentlemen as Gaius and Titius, and to their book as the Green Book. But I promise you, there is such a book, I have it on my shelves.
I mean, then goes on to describe a scene, actually reporting from the book, second chapter of the book. I'll just read it. In their second chapter, Gaius and Didius quote the well-known story of Coleridge at the waterfall. You remember that there were two tourists present, that one called it sublime and the other pretty, and that Coleridge mentally endorsed the first judgment and rejected the second with disgust. Gaius and Didius comment as follows. When the man said, "That is sublime," he appeared to be making a remark about the waterfall. Actually, he was not making a remark about the waterfall, but a remark about his own feelings. What he was saying was really, "I have feelings associated in my mind with the word sublime," or shortly, "I have sublime feelings." Here are a good many, end quote. Here are a good many deep questions settled in a pretty summary fashion, but the authors are not yet finished. They add, "This confusion is continually present in language as we use it. We appear to be saying something very important about something, and actually we are only saying something about our own feelings." Skip ahead. Here's Lewis's summary of what this does. The schoolboy who reads this passage in the Green Book will believe two propositions. First, that all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about the emotional state of the speaker. And second, that all such statements are unimportant. So, you see in the textbook a turn, right? So the scene they describe is someone looking at a waterfall who says, "That is sublime." He looks at something outside of himself. I don't even know how you would define sublime. It's not a word I use very often. We'll just say beautiful, sublime, peaceful, has a character of sublimity. He looks at it and says, "That is sublime." And what the authors say is it appears that he's making a statement about the waterfall, but what he's really talking about is himself. Do you see the turn? It's a turn from making a comment, a declarative statement about some objective reality outside of himself. And the authors are saying, no, he's not really talking about that waterfall. He's talking about his own feelings. He's talking and reflecting on a reality internal to himself. And they've severed the connection, twofold connection. One, that there's something called sublime or beautiful that is real and can be pointed at and can be talked about. They've said that is unimportant and it can't actually be done. In reality, language is not talking about objective realities outside of ourselves. It's talking about ourselves. It's talking about what we feel. And what I feel right now in light of this waterfall is something like sublime. So they've done, first thing is they've said, hey, I'm not talking about some objective reality out there, I'm talking about myself. And two, they've said that those feelings are unimportant, they don't matter. They're not how we feel and its connection to objective reality outside of itself, that there's any connection there at all, is unimportant. They've severed that. Now, what Lewis is going to go on to argue over the course of these three chapters is once you've done that, you've destroyed humanity. Once you've drawn a sharp disconnection between the object of our desires and those desires themselves, humanity does not exist any longer. There's no way that society or culture or reality can continue to exist. I'm going to jump ahead. Has anybody read this book? Do you like it? I didn't really like it. I agreed with it. All right, y'all ready? This is the end of chapter one. The very end of chapter one. If I can get there. The chest. So here's what he's saying, that there's a reality out there. We're supposed to conform to that reality. What these authors are doing and what all of modern history is doing is severing the connection between joy and truth, between my feelings and their appropriateness to what is real and what is out there and what is firm and what is seeable. By severing that, we remove man's ability we remove man's ability to pursue anything that has meaning. So he says this, the chest, magnanimity, sentiment. These are the indispensable liaison officers between cerebral man and visceral man. It may even be said that it is by this middle element that man is man. For by his intellect, he is mere spirit, and by his appetite, mere animal. The operation of the green book and its kind is to produce what may be called men without chests. It is an outrage that they should be commonly spoken of as intellectuals. It's really nice to these guys. This gives them the chance to say that he who attacks them attacks intelligence. It is not so. They are not distinguished from other men by any unusual skill in finding truth, nor any virginal ardor to pursue her. Indeed, it would be strange if they were. A persevering devotion to truth, a nice sense of intellectual honor, cannot be long maintained without the aid of a sentiment which Gaius and Titius could debunk as easily as any other. It is not excess of thought, but defect in fertile and generous emotion that marks them out. Their heads are no bigger than the ordinary. It is the atrophy of the chest beneath that makes them seem so. And all the time, such is the tragic comedy of our situation, we continue to clamor for those very qualities we are rendering impossible. You can hardly open a periodical without coming across the statement that what our civilization needs is more drive or dynamism or self-sacrifice or creativity. In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. He says that when you remove a notion of objectivity to truth, beauty, or morality and goodness, and then you come and are shocked to find traitors in your midst, you shouldn't be. You've taken the whole idea of honor and said it is not objective. It's not based in anything real. It's not based in the existence of a God who demands honor. It's not based in any real objective standard that should be held by everyone everywhere. It's just an idea, a sentiment, an emotion that has floated through our culture. And then everyone stands in awe as they watch that culture begin to disintegrate. We can now talk about honor all we want, but if we've removed its basis in reality from being objective and outside of us, ordered by God, if you will, if we've removed that, then why should anyone die for their country? And that becomes the running example through the rest of the book, is the argument of why should anyone die for their country? Again, remember, he's writing during the days of World War II. How can you call men to go to the German front and die when you've told them that there is no objective reality that demands it? You can't. So when you create a secular society, when there's nothing outside of us, you kill any and all universal notions of objective goodness, objective truth, objective beauty, and you have nothing left. So abolition of man begins there by essentially arguing that, hey, when you sever that, you lose everything. And that's where he begins in chapter 1, chapter 2. He begins to take on the actual arguments of secularists who in the light of their secularism, are trying to say, no, but we can still create a society that pursues justice. We can still create a society where people don't kill one another. We can still create a society where some men show honor and are willing to die for their country. And he shows all of those arguments to simply be hollow, to all come crashing down on the same rocks. Some of the best arguments against atheism in the world, I think, are in chapter 2 of Abolition of Man. And some of the best debaters against atheists I've ever heard have basically taken chapter 2, stolen it, and kind of reframed it with their own examples. Chapter 3, he moves then to argue that once you've done that, once you've removed an objective reality in which truth, beauty, and goodness is based, and you've lost therefore you've lost the foundations on which to build any sort of meaningful society or meaningful culture. The last step is that therefore tyranny will win always. Might will then make right. The only answer to why should I not steal your piece of fruit, or why should I do this or that? The right answer becomes, because I have a gun to your face. The one who has the most power will then reign and rule forever. So that's where he goes in chapter 3 of Abolition of Man. This is the fight he wages in that book. I actually did like the book. It's just chapter 3 is hard for me, I'll be honest with you. Another interesting piece about Abolition of Man, he's trying to write this. He's giving these lectures not to a Christian audience. And so he's making these arguments not on the basis of scripture, not on the basis, but really philosophical arguments. He never goes to God. He uses a phrase called the Tao, which is his kind of reference to this commonality held by every worldview ever, that there is a right and a wrong, that these things are universal and should be believed. So he references it's the Buddhist Tao, Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism. They all have something called the law or the Tao that determines for them, hey, this is right or this is wrong. And it becomes kind of a basis for everything else. So he uses that as kind of a, hey, this isn't just a Christian idea that's been there in every society. And so he's not actually making Christian arguments in this book. He's just trying to argue for it. Goodness's objectivity, that it's there. And that our behavior, our emotions, our responses to it should accord with it. And it matters that those two things connect. So that's Abolition of Man. Yeah. I think so. In the sense that, actually, no, I don't think it helps you at all. In the sense that I don't think Lewis is talking about the same thing, if that makes sense. So what I tend to find in those conversations, which happen frequently in Boulder in this neighborhood, is that there's a sense in which it's kind of the ultimate, it's the ultimate kind of postmodern move, right? So now reality is not out there to be subject to, it's now subject to me. I define reality. I define the world as I want it to be. Now, nobody can live with that, in all honesty. Like, eventually, if you drive through the stop sign when somebody's coming, they're going to hit you whether you want it to happen or not. Like, it's just going to happen. Like, so that I think, philosophy becomes nonsensical quickly. But Lewis is essentially, he's cutting that off like three moves before they get there, right? So they're... That way of talking sounds like, oh, I'm conforming to reality around me, but really you're not. You're trying to make reality conform to you, which I would say is just three steps further down the road towards insanity. And I don't mean insanity as like a mental illness. I mean insanity as like refusing to conform to reality, right? That you're refusing to see the world as it actually is. In one sense, Lewis won't help you at all because he's back here and you guys are already down there. He's waving his hands going, I told you, this is where he's going to go. And they're going, yes, this is where we are. We're all one. So, yeah, that's good. Any other questions? I'm bad at questions, but I'll try to be good at them. All right, we're done with Abolition of Man. Do you guys want to take a break? All right, Space Trilogy. Y'all ready? You guys excited about Space Trilogy? Who's read Space Trilogy? You guys love them? When you try to give them away, everybody looks at you weird. You give them away at Christmas. Like, you buy the 3-pack and you give them to your sister-in-law. Not this sister-in-law, but another sister-in-law. And she looks at you like, why are you giving these to me? I don't like science fiction. That happened to me. Okay, so... Space Trilogy is three books. Begins with Out of the Silent Planet, moves on to the second one, Perelandra, and three is That Hideous Strength. Number of people have noted that there's a massive stylistic difference between the first two and the third. Did you notice it when you read it? If you haven't read it, there's a massive stylistic difference between the first two and the third, and that can be all chalked up to his friendship with a guy named Charles Williams. Between the second book and the third book, he became close friends with a guy named Charles Williams, who, one of the funny things about Charles Williams is anybody who talks about Charles Williams always, no matter how good of friends they were with him, describe him as weird. Everybody. So Van Alkins in Severe Mercy. And when they start talking about Charles Williams, they describe him as weird. Lewis describes him as weird. Tolkien describes him as weird. Everybody describes this guy as just a complete weirdo. But he had massive influence on all these people. So it kind of makes me wish I'd have known Charles Williams, because he's so weird and so influential. I've never read Charles Williams. I just started one of Charles Williams' books. And I now understand the style of Hideous Strength, because Charles Williams is terrifying as a writer. He's been called like the supernatural Christian Stephen King. And it's terrifying. So I'm reading this book, but I'm all the whole time going like, oh, this is where Lewis got this kind of prose from, the Hideous Strength. First, let me set up the story of all three. Three basic characters you need to know as they run through all three books. The first is Ransom. I told you last night, gave it away. His character is based on J.R. Tolkien. Ransom is a professor of philology at Oxford. Gives it away. And the whole story begins out of the side of the planet. He is going on a holiday. And for him, a holiday means going with a backpack and just walking. This is what you do in England. So you just go for long walks for weeks on end. And so he goes on a long walk. On his long walk, in the beginning of Out of Sight of the Planet, he meets Professor Weston and Professor Devine. And they are up to no good. They have, it appears, to have kidnapped young boy who's been working for them. And they are trying to drug him and tie him up and put him in what looks like to be a large orb. So Ransom seeks to rescue the boy, instead finds himself drugged and on board a spaceship. Spaceship goes to Mars, which is not Mars in the book, goes to Mars, and there they encounter all kinds of alien races. And so that goes with Out of the Silent Planet. You move into Paralandra. Ransom at the end of, I'll go ahead and give it away, he returns to Earth alive. Gave the whole book away. So returns to Earth alive. Paralandra takes up the gods from the first book, order him to go to what is our version of Venus, where the world is being born. And so we get a picture of what it looks like for this world to be born with the original man and the original woman on this planet. And we see played out over the course of that book, what if the story of our world had gone differently? And so we have Weston appears, Professor Weston from the first book, appears in the second book, utterly twisted. He is called the Unman throughout the second book, and he goes to Eve, and throughout the book is trying to tempt Eve and call Eve away from trusting and obeying Melendiel, the god, the label for God, to turn away from him, to disobey him, to do anything to express her own independence from him. And Ransom has been sent as a representative of Melendiel to call her to obedience, to trust, to love, and to trust that Melendiel is for her and for her good, and that she should obey him. The book culminates kind of the climactic scene, and if you're a crier, you'll cry, with this beautiful image of Adam and Eve being crowned as these kind of God's representatives on the earth, to rule the earth with kindness and with gentleness and care and love and grace. And then Ransom gets to see that happen, see what could have been on earth had Adam and Eve not fallen and turned away from God, and then he's sent back to earth. And then the third book, nobody goes anywhere. It all happens on earth. And so we see Dr. Devine return, and he's leading an organization called NICE, which is interesting for a whole bunch of reasons as you read the book. And this organization is trying to kind of culminate their master plan of an undying human race. One of the main themes that runs through all three of these books is man's insane and obsessive fear of death. It really controls a lot of the narrative. You begin to see that how many wicked and horrific things a man is willing to do to avoid and not have to face the specter of death. And one of the most interesting conversations happened in the very first book as Ransom is having a conversation with one of the divine figures. One of the things that's interesting about this medieval worldview is you have a really interesting cosmology of Melendiel at the top, So he's, some of you in this room are already thinking like the whole Lord of the Rings geek out thing. I totally know that this is nerdy, I don't care. So you have Melindil, and then you have the Lysira. I'm not going to spell it right. Is that sort of right? I'm going to keep looking to you. So he's more nerdy than I am. So, and then you're going to know it. Yeah. So it doesn't totally work with our understanding of the universe, but essentially, you'd have God, you have God-like angelic beings, and then you have angelic beings. Okay? Makes a lot of sense, right? Perfect. Okay, so so as you work through these three books, Ransom is interacting with a bunch of the different levels. But anyway, he's interacting with the, or whatever you say, he's interacting with that guy on Mars, and he begins asking questions like, well, why would anyone avoid death? Like, the question is like, Ransom's trying to give an argument for why Weston is so persistent on finding a planet that the human race can continually go to and find life in. Arasa's just asking this question, like, well, why is that such a big deal? And then Ransom keeps going out, well, he doesn't want to die. And he's like, well, doesn't he know that death is supposed to happen? Like, it's one of the things that Melindiel has ordained, is that planets die and people die and species die. And that's just how the universe is. And because of Weston's refusal to conform to that reality, he becomes slowly and increasingly more insane. That the closing scenes and Out of the Side of the Planet are really hilarious, as Weston is kind of playing out this insanity in front of this very wise, very kind of quiet, godlike figure almost. And then you see that turn in Perelandra as he becomes kind of the embodiment of evil itself, trying to breed corruption into the very fabric of Venus as it's being born. And then the third book, That Hideous Strength, Divine, is again trying to play this plan to end death. And so their great plan, I mean, it sounds crazy, but it makes a lot of sense. The book is, they want to have a disembodied brain that can just live on forever and ever and ever. That's how they want to create the perfect humanity. Perfect humanity has no sex, has no food, has no wine, has no beer. Sounds awful to me. Has no mud. It has no filth. It just is pure thought, disembodied thought. And so it gives you a sense of Lewis's understanding of the goodness of creation, right? Of quiddity, that ultimate evil would be portrayed as trying to disembody everything. And the contrast with Nice, the organization that's seeking to do that to all of humanity, is the Pendragon, the organization gathered around Ransom, who's become almost like this Christ-like figure as he's become increasingly holy through these books and his interactions with and his communion with Melindiel, the god. He becomes increasingly holy and this Christ-like figure by the third book. And his organization is all about really good. I mean, the emphasis there is food and wine and smoking and good marriages and all that entails. And that's all happening on their side of the fence. And then the really clean, tidy, kind of uptight, morally righteous ones are the Nice group. And that's an interesting contrast that kind of plays out in the third book. Anything else I want to say about that? Any good quotes I want to read? Anybody who's read them have anything to add? Here's a great quote. Somebody raise their hand. Did I miss? No? Okay. Here's a great quote. So in the third book, there is a woman named Jane. She has no idea where she stands on any of this. She's just tired of her husband. Her husband works for Nice. And she's gone now to meet Ransom and meet with this group. There's an interesting, awkward first interaction between her and Ransom. She thinks she's falling in love with him. And they're having this kind of awkward conversation. At one point in the conversation, you're kind of getting to hear her thoughts through the narrator, and she's talking about kind of all of these kind of sensuous ideas that are coming to her mind as she's interacting with Ransom. And Ransom can just kind of read what's going on in her mind, and he just goes, "Hey, stop it." And but anyway, and then they're having this whole interaction about how she should deal with her husband, who's still working at NICE. And he says, this is the conversation. She says, "But is it really necessary?" She began. "I don't think I look on marriage quite as you do. It seems to me extraordinary that everything should hang on what Mark says about something he doesn't understand. He's saying to her, you need to go to your husband and try to get him to leave NICE and come and join you." And then Ransom says to her, "Child," said the director, "it's not a question of how you or I look on marriage, but how my masters look on it. Someone said they were very old-fashioned, but well, that was a joke. They're not old-fashioned, but they are very, very old. They would never think of finding out first whether Mark and I believed in their idea of marriage," Jane said back to her. "In other words, they wouldn't care what we thought first." He said, "Well, no," said the director with a curious smile. "No, quite definitely, they wouldn't think of doing that." In other words, they have an idea, an objective idea of what marriage is. They don't really care what you think. And so if you're going to violate that understanding of marriage and kind of walk away from your husband and walk away from your marriage, it's not going to be so easy as you have a different opinion than they do about what marriage is. So you see that kind of same theme of objective truth, objective reality coming through. Any questions about the trilogy? This is going way faster than I thought. Please read the trilogy. It's so good. Next person that calls it science fiction, I'm going to correct them and say it's not science fiction. My pastor, who knows all things, told me that it is not science fiction. It is not science fiction at all. I actually read most of Out of the Silent Planet today just to kind of get fresh on the trilogy. And the closest I can actually hold it to, it's more like Lord of the Rings than it is like science fiction. Only completely different. So I don't know how to do that. But it's not science fiction. So space trilogy, there it is. All right, so we want to go to Till We Have Faces or Great Divorce. Till We Have Faces? Nodding. Okay, Till We Have Faces. We'll have plenty of time. We'll get to both. All right. So C.S. Lewis takes an ancient myth. He twists it a bit in a really small way and rewrites it, retells the story. It is essentially the story of there's three sisters in the story. The story focuses on the life of two of the sisters, Psyche and Aurel, or Mara. Aurel, and their relationship. Psyche represents, here's how Lewis actually described the book. Psyche represents a new young Christian who's been born again, who discovers when I read this and his description of it, it changed my whole view of the book. But she has discovered Christianity and she grows up into it, loves it, is obsessed with it, and delights in it. Her sister represents the unimpressed and unconvinced agnostic who loves that person dearly. And their relationship, as that plays out, is really meant to be an illustration of that. He actually says as much. Can I read you a letter from him? Again, I don't care what you say. I'm going to do what I want to do. Here it is. In my version of Cupid and Psyche, Apuleius got it wrong. The elder sister, I reduce her to one, couldn't see Psyche's palace when she visited her. She saw only rock and heather. And when Psyche said she was giving her noble wine, the poor sister saw and tasted only spring water. Hence her dreadful problem. Is Psyche mad or am I blind? As you see, though I didn't start from that, it is the story of every nice, affectionate agnostic whose dearest one suddenly gets religion, or even every lukewarm Christian whose dearest gets a vocation or a calling, never, I think, treated sympathetically by a Christian writer before. I do it all through the mouth of the elder sister. In a word, I'm very much with Book. In other words, it's very much his own experience. In fact, as Alan Jacobs recounts kind of the story of Lewis's conversion, there's a questionable and interesting relationship, a long-standing relationship that Lewis had with one of his good friend's mothers. read Jacobs' book. And she was a pretty hardened agnostic atheist. And he was living with her at the time when he became a Christian. Her response is very much like the older sisters in the books. She was hardened, she was angry, she was bitter, and she grew into that bitterness over the course of her life, even more so. That relationship in itself could be a book. Some would say Lewis's first marriage, even though it was never actually a marriage. But it was a weird one because it was his friend's mom. Then became something else. And then it became more of an elderly mom taking care of her relationship. So that's sticky. We'll avoid it. But this book is coming from kind of his experience there. As he came to faith in Jesus, he was discovering this beauty that he'd longed for his whole life. And the person that he felt closest to in the world became increasingly bitter and angry towards that discovery by him. So much so that it really transformed their relationship in pretty devastating ways. The book itself is essentially the story of this very, very ugly sister and this very, very beautiful sister. The beautiful sister has almost a divine kind of life. She is offered as a sacrifice to the gods, and she is taken, and she goes desirous of that, and it is her older sister's discovery of that desire which leads to bitterness that kind of marks the rest of her life. It's one of the books that, even as I was sitting there trying to explain it to people, it's one of the hardest books to explain I've ever read. And when you do explain it, it sounds kind of flat, but then you read it and you cry a lot. So let me read a couple quotes that I have found particularly moving and helpful. Okay? First, a quote. This is a quote from Lewis. Somebody asked him about the title. He says, "How can they, the gods, meet us face to face till we have faces?" The idea was that a human being must become real before it can expect to receive any message from the superhuman. That is, it must be speaking with its own voice, not one of its borrowed voices, expressing its actual desires, not what it imagines that it desires, being for good or ill itself, not any mask, veil, or persona. That the only grounds on which the gods will meet us, the only ground on which God himself will meet us, is on the ground in which we are fully exposed. That grace is only found when we stand naked before him. When our ugliness is seen, that the nature of our voice is actually our real voice, and not what we presume, not what we pretend, and not the masks that we wear for one another, but the real person that's in there, the real desires that drive us and define us. When those are finally and fully exposed, it is there and only there that we will see God, that we will hear God, that we will be confronted by God, that we will be loved by God and forgiven by God. It's there and only there. And so that lay at the heart of the book. There is a scene early on. You see kind of these themes of is truth objective and real, particularly is religious truth objective and real. You see those themes kind of playing out throughout the book. Early on in the book, the priest of Unget is the name for God in the book. The priest of Unget, who has been described by the older sister in the most defiling terms ever, he's just a political maneuvering, trying to lie, trying to tell stories, trying to essentially kind of assert his own power over and over again. And she's also terrified of him. There's kind of a weird mix going on back and forth. She sits, she argues as forceful as she can over and over again. Everything he believes, everything he does isn't real. And yet she is utterly terrified her entire life of Unget, the priest, all of it. I don't know how many of you know people like that. There's a debate between Doug Wilson and Christopher Hitchens. And Doug Wilson says at one point during the debate, man, you're proving the two fundamental premises of all atheists. He says, one, there is no God, and two, I hate him. And that you see that played out with the older sister again and again. There is no God. It's false. It's not true. It can't be real. You're just doing these weird ceremonies and sacrificing cattle, and that cattle could be used to feed animals or feed people. And this is all that's going on. And then she trembles and is terrified of the reality, and speaks often of how much she hates the priest and hates Unget herself. And she's standing. There's a scene early on. The priest comes and is and speaking words of condemnation to the king. The older sister is there. Some other counselors are there. And the king, at one point, just gets tired of it all, takes a dagger and holds it, like literally starting to stab the priest, and begins to threaten the priest, saying, "What are you going to do now?" And then here's what the older sister sees. She says, "I have never, to speak of things merely mortal, seen anything more wonderful than the priest's stillness. Hardly any man can be quite still when a finger, much less a dagger, is thrust into the place between two ribs. The priest was, no, I cut it off. Dang it. The priest was still. Even his hands did not tighten on the arms of the chair. Never moving his head or changing his voice, he said, 'Drive it in, King, swift or slow, if it pleases you. It will make no difference. Be sure the great offering will be made, whether I am dead or living. I am here in the strength of Unget. While I have breath, I am Unget's voice, perhaps longer. A priest does not wholly die. I may visit your palace more often, both by day and night, if you kill me. The others will not see me, but I think you will.' This was the worst yet. The fox, one of the counselors who had been her tutor, had taught me to think, at any rate to speak, of the priest as a mere schemer and a politic man who put into the mouth of Unget whatever might most increase his own power and lands or most harm his enemies. I saw it was not so. He was sure of Unget. Looking at him as he sat with the dagger pricking him and his blind eyes unwinking, fixed on the king and his face like an eagle's face, I was sure too. Our real enemy was not a mortal. The room was full of spirits and the horror of holiness." There is kind of haunting this book, this constant doubting thought, what if there really is a God? And how terrifying would it be to meet him? The book culminates in the final scene, one of the final scenes, with the older sister. I'm standing before the gods and voicing her complaint. And her complaint was that the gods devour. Actually, I'm not even gonna do the service of asking. I'm just gonna read it. She stands offering her complaints to the gods, and I love this section. I'm stepping into the middle of her speech. Those we love best, whoever's most worth loving, those are the very ones you'll pick out. Oh, I can see it happening, age after age, and growing worse and worse the more you reveal your beauty. The son turning his back on the mother, and the bride on her groom, stolen away by this everlasting calling, calling, calling of the gods, taken where we can't follow. It would be far better for us if you were foul and ravening. We'd rather you drank their blood than stole their hearts. We'd rather they were ours and dead than yours and made immortal. But to steal her love from me, to make her see things I couldn't see. She's sorry, interrupting. She's speaking of her beautiful sister who saw the gods, who saw it all, who was drawn up into it while she was left not seeing it. But to steal her love from me, to make her see things I couldn't see, oh, you'll say, you've been whispering it to me these 40 years, that I had signs enough her palace was real, could have known the truth if I wanted. But how could I want to know it? Tell me that. The girl was mine. What right had you to steal her away into your dreadful heights? You'll say I was jealous. Jealous of Psyche? Not while she was mine. If you'd gone the other way to work, if it was my eyes you had opened, you'd soon have seen how I would have shown her and told her and taught her and led her up to my level. But to hear a chit of a girl who had or ought to have had no thought in her head that I'd not put there, setting up for a seer and a prophetess and next thing to a goddess, how could anyone endure it? That's why I say it makes no difference whether you're fair or foul, that there should be gods at all. Theirs are misery and bitterness. Or wrong. There's no room for you and us in the same world. You're a tree in whose shadow we cannot thrive. We want to be our own. I was my own, and Psyche was mine, and no one else had any right to her. Oh, you'll say you took her away into bliss and joy, such as I could never have given her, and I ought to have been glad for it, glad of it for her sake. Why? What should I care for some horrible new happiness which I hadn't given her and which separated her from me? Do you think I wanted her to be happy that way? It would have been better if I'd seen the brute tear her in pieces before my eyes. You stole her to make her happy, did you? Why, every wheedling, smiling, catfoot rogue who lures away another man's wife or slave or dog might say the same. Dog, now, that's very much to the purpose. I'll thank you to let me feed my own. It needed no tidbits from your table. Did you ever remember whose the girl was? She was mine. Mine. Do you not know that the word means mine? You're thieves, seducers. That's my wrong. I'll not complain, not now, that you're blood drinkers and man eaters. I'm past that. Enough, said the judge. There was utter silence all around me. And now for the first time, I knew what I'd been doing. While I was reading, it had once and again seemed strange to me that the reading took so long, for the book was a small one. It's a book of her complaints. Now I knew that I had been reading it over and over, perhaps a dozen times. I would have read it forever, quick as I could, starting the first word again, almost before the last was out of my mouth, if the judge had not stopped me. And the voice I read it in was strange to my ears. There was given to me a certainty that this, at last, was my real voice. There was silence in the dark assembly, long enough for me to have read my book out yet again. At last, the judge spoke. Are you answered? He said. Yes, said I. What happens next is her conversion. What happened in that moment as she's reciting her complaints to the judge is she actually begins to hear that all of her life she'd been saying again and again and again, I love Psyche, I love Psyche, I love Psyche. I hate the gods because they've demanded her blood, they've taken her from me. When in reality, what she discovers in these last scenes is in reality, she hated Psyche. That her love for Psyche was really that she wanted her for herself. She didn't want her to know the enjoyment, the bliss, the glory of the gods. It's beautiful, sorry. But any thoughts, questions about Two Way Faces? Yeah. Yes, no. I think that's the... I think one of the beauties of the book is like you step into, he even says in a letter writing about the book, is that Unget represented kind of a pagan understanding of God that's shot through with truth. It's kind of, he imagines pagan kind of groping after the ideal of God, the ideal of Christianity, not quite getting there, but having something that echoed it, if you will. I found myself, I liked the parts of Unget that made you tremble and fear, which was there a lot. So I liked that. Yeah. Right? Yeah, it feels like Leviticus to me. So I can't say I hate the God of Leviticus. You're touching on, I think, what was at the heart of the email I got from my friends in Texas. They look at places like Leviticus and they see this God who demands blood. I mean, I recently, in kind of my Bible reading deal, went through Leviticus. And I just kept writing over and over again in my Bible, like, the blood. So much blood. To worship Yahweh, to live in the presence of Yahweh. The thing that will stand out to you in Leviticus, and I get bored with Leviticus quickly because it's very minutia, but the thing that just stands out to me in the book over and over and over and over again is the sheer amount of blood necessary to live in the presence of God. It's astounding. And then you move forward to Christ and it becomes beautiful. But I think that's hitting on that rub as we encounter a God who's truly holy and other and terrifying, and we don't know what to do with him. And we find ourselves maybe sympathizing with the older sister and hating him or her in that case. But good. We have 3 minutes. Do you want to do Great Divorce or go? Great Divorce. We'll do it in 3 minutes. So Great Divorce, phenomenal book. You should read it. Dude finds himself in hell. sorry. And hell is essentially the suburbs. The gray London suburbs is hell, according to C.S. Lewis. And so, no real city, just row houses in every direction with gray skies and a grayness about everything. His ability to describe hell as not vivid flames and piercing pain and a lot of the popular images of hell, but rather hell is the ever-decreasing vividness of everything. I don't know if that makes sense. So one way to think of heaven and hell for Lewis is hell is all of life being emptied of what makes it living. So colors become increasingly gray. People become increasingly gray. The weather becomes increasingly gray. Everything just becomes increasingly gray and distant and non-eventful and non-noticeable and just silent. So that kind of the outer reaches of hell, where he places Napoleon, actually, is he lives on a house, a big house, by himself, away from everyone. That's the farthest reaches of hell in C.S. Lewis's mind. People are constantly moving out from the center of hell because they want to get away from people. So hell is other people. And some introverts in the room might say that's true. But that's hell as you play it out for Lewis. And so what people who live close to the city, you can go to a bus stop, and you get to take a bus and go to heaven, or at least the front porch of heaven. And so this guy gets on the bus. He hasn't been in hell very long, so he's kind of excited to see what this whole thing's about. And he arrives in heaven, and here's the contrast. He gets to heaven, and there's grass, and there's color, and it's all vivid, and it's all real, but everything weighs more. It has more life to it. It has more vividness to it. So the blades of grass are literally almost piercing through his feet because they're so substantive, so weighty. And he, as someone who has lost that going into hell, has lost his own weight, has lost his own firmness, his own realness. And so he can barely stand to even stand on the grass. There's a funny scene where there's a drop of water that's falling off a leaf on a tree, and it's coming towards him, and he's convinced, he's literally diving to avoid the rain. It reminded me of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and they're trying to run away from the rain. Like he's like, if this water falls on me, it will crush me. It will literally crush me. And so you see here, like, in Lewis's whole understanding of the world, like, the whole idea of quiddity, what we talked about last night, the substance of what's real and reality in heaven is this gets bigger and better, and everything tastes better and smells better and looks better. It's not that we evacuate this world and become bodiless. No, that's hell for Lewis. Reality is more substance, more beauty, more joy, more pleasure, more of it in its fullness. This man arrives in heaven, and then he goes and basically gets to kind of listen in on a series of conversations between people who've come from the depths of heaven to come and meet their beloved who's visiting them from hell, and hear these people try to convince their loved ones to let go of their sin and to come with them into heaven. And it's an interesting progression. Hey, if you'll just come with me and walk, I know it hurts, but soon your feet will learn their firmness again. And you can journey with me to see the heights and the glory and the beauty of who God is. And nobody goes. And so you get to listen in on these conversations. And this is where I think the real power of this narrative comes, is you begin to hear particular idolatries and how they have driven these people mad, so mad that they would prefer hell. They would prefer to be away from their loved ones than to have to submit or let go of those idols and come and worship God. And so you kind of play through this this whole scene. There's actually a humorous scene. One of Lewis's biggest influences in his life was George MacDonald. George MacDonald was a famed Universalist, and Lewis, the protagonist in the book, meets George MacDonald, or a character that's meant to be George MacDonald in the book, and George basically admits he was wrong in the book. So it's kind of Lewis's way of winning the argument with his mentor by putting him in a book and having him finally admit he was wrong after he was dead. But he's still in heaven. And so that plays out that way. This book has generated largely most of the controversy that will surround Lewis, because it portrays a possibility that Lewis, interestingly, in the book, that no one takes him up on it, which I think that's the horror of the book. The terror of the book is that those in hell would be offered an opportunity to repent even after death, and they would all say no, which I think very much squares with not necessarily the opportunity to repent, but the idea that the imagery Christ uses is there will be much gnashing of teeth, that image. The image that is used in the New Testament to describe those in hell, that there's much gnashing of teeth. That's usually described by a commentator sometimes as, that's how much pain they're in, or it's thought about, they're in so much pain, they're gnashing their teeth. It's nowhere is that phrase ever connote pain. It always connotes rage and anger. The image that the Bible gives us of those in hell are not people who, man, I wish I could go to heaven, and I'm really sad, and I'm filled with regret, and I am in a lot of pain for the rest of eternity. That's not the image at all. It is the image of unchecked rage against the existence of God playing out forever and ever and ever. And so that turn for Lewis, that to me was the most striking thing about the book, is that he's showing what that looks like. Men and women who are being offered, even he's saying, hey, this is completely a myth. This isn't actual real. This isn't, we don't have any reason to believe this actually happens anywhere in the Bible. In fact, we have quite the opposite reason to believe this happens in the Bible. But let me show you the terror of sin. Even if God releases you to it, even if you were shown the opportunity of what it would mean to come to God and to let go of these scabs that you cling to. I heard Nate Wilson describe the nature of hell as us clinging to our scabs. Even if God were to offer you and place you right at the front door and say, come in, those in hell would cling all the tighter to their scabs and refuse. That's what humanity unchecked by grace is. And so that, I think, is the real terror of that book. It shows hey, any of us, unmitigated by grace, would love our own sin more than we would love God and endless delights and pleasures at his right hand. We'd rather live in a gray, drab, isolated world than to live with God or deal with the great interferer, as Lewis called him, known as God. Thoughts, questions about Great Divorce? We're over 5 minutes. I'm sorry. I scolded somebody a few months ago for going over 5 minutes. Okay, cool. If you guys have questions after, I'll be around. Thanks. This is a blast to get to teach and talk about. I hope it was helpful. Most of all, I hope it pushes you to go read Lewis. So thanks for coming.